MD, RadioMD.com.
He's a cardiologist. He's a chef. He's America's culinary interventionalist. It's time for Code Delicious with Dr. Michael Fenster.
Hello, Food Nation, Healthy Nation. Are you ready for the scrumptious and the salubrious all wrapped up into one tasty audio treat? I know that you are, and I know you know. That means it's time once again for another Code Delicious. I am the one and only Dr. Mike. I am here with two other doctors today, Dr. Michelle Perro. She's a veteran pediatrician, over 3 decades worth of experience in both acute and integrative medicine, which I absolutely love. About a decade ago, she got really interested in expanding the views in health advocacy, including addressing pesticides, which, as all of you know, is near and dear to my heart as well, pun intended, as you know. We've also got Dr. Vincent Adams. She's a PhD professor and vice chair of medical anthropology at the University of California. Her most recent book is Metrics, What Counts in Global Health, recently published. You probably want to go get about 12 copies of that. She is also the editor-in-chief for Medical Anthropology Quarterly, flagship journal for the Society for Medical Anthropology. I can't wait to get started on our topics today. Doctors, thank you so much for joining me today and being on the show.
Thank you, Dr. Mike. Glad to be here.
Likewise. Glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit, if each of you could share a little bit about how you got to your perspective today, because I know, at least speaking, you know, from physician to physician, Dr. Perro, you know, this, what you're talking about, the advocacy, particularly, you know, some of the issues surrounding the use of pesticides and food, it's not really a career path in medical school. We don't get to choose that one when we're looking at our residency options. So it's an interesting to find you at the top of the same mountain as myself, and I'd love to hear how you wound up here.
Be happy to answer that for you, Dr. Mike. It's serendipity. That's how. You know, it was not my calling. So what happened was there was a spray of pesticides going on here along the entire coast of Northern California in about 2006. And one of my patients needed a pediatrician to be on her board to stop the spray. And she asked me. And I was extremely reluctant. Busy mom, small kids, PTA, business. You know the deal, right? I think you were talking about type A and type B on your show. Well, I was working type A quality. And I got involved, and through that pesticide advocacy work, which I had never penned myself for, I learned about GMOs through a smart mom. And she started saying, hey, Michelle, what do you think about GMOs? And I didn't have much thought about it. And she referred me to Jeffrey Smith's work, Seeds of Deception. And I started reading about the work of a scientist named Dr. Arpad Pusey, now one of my heroes, who introduced me to the idea of the research in genetic modification when it was first being introduced into Europe. That was in 1996, his work. And I had light bulbs flashing off and said, uh-oh, because my background's in acute care, and I was running my own urgent care at the time with a blend of integrative medicine, and I was seeing a lot of acute on chronic illness, Mike, kids really sick, and I thought, okay. And I started putting the pieces together. So kind of a long answer, but that's how I got here.
Well, the long answers are always the most interesting and often the best ones. Vincent, Dr. Adams, how about yourself?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So, you know, I'm a medical anthropologist, and I've been publishing research on the social dynamics and politics of health for many years and in many books. And, you know, I've always been interested in, as an anthropologist, the ethnographic method, which is trying to look at the social and fleshy human impact of, you know, big social and structural and political problems. In any case, I met Michelle, and I found her story so compelling, I felt I really couldn't help but get involved. And helping her with some of the information that I brought to the table about the history and politics of these situations. But what is amazing to me is that I was surprised, because like a lot of people, I was initially really skeptical of Michelle's position on GM food. Anyone looking at the internet for information on this will be easily convinced that GM foods are safe and that those who oppose them are just conspiracy theorists. You know, I can see the eye rolling that happens every time I tell someone I'm writing a book on this. I was writing a book on this. But, you know, after I dug deeper and I looked over Michelle's shoulder and I started reading the science myself and we started interviewing her patients, I realized this is just a huge problem. And we've really been in a situation where the world's been pulled over our eyes, I think, and we need, you know, we need more science, we need more valid data, we need more work looking at the role of food in medicine, but also on how to stop this epidemic. So after all that, I just said, I can't get involved. I wanted to write a book about her. She wanted to write a book. We wrote it together.
That is absolutely fabulous. And you know, I couldn't agree with you guys enough. And the only thing I'd add is that we need more voices of credible people like yourself. You know, I go out and I talk, and I can't tell you sort of the blacklisting and the eye rolling and the door slamming in my face sort of thing when I talk about this. But it's you bring up 1996, which is a very important year because that's when Monsanto first released the GMOs. And obviously, for those new folks in our audience, GMOs, genetically modified organisms. And I want to take a moment just to kind of step back on that because I think it's important when we talk about GMOs, we understand kind of a little bit about the history there. So, you know, in your research, you know, what did you come across in terms of some things that kind of set the alarm bells off, you know, back when you were seeing these kids show up and then you kind of looked into the GMOs?
So what set the alarm off for me was I was seeing, as I mentioned, kids with chronic diseases. And many of the diseases stemmed around gut function, right? The intestine. Kids have a very long list of complaints, including chronic abdominal pain, constipation, reflux, which is underdiagnosed. Unfortunately, autoimmune diseases, including the gut, if I'm just focusing on the gut right now. When I saw Dr. Pusey's work, and he fed rats genetically modified potatoes, and it was a beautiful study. Two groups of rats, one fed GM genetically modified potatoes, one not. Very simple, very elegant, and a man who knew pesticides very well. What Dr. Pusey found was the stomach had pathological changes, meaning when he looked at those slides, Dr. Mike, he saw growth changes in the cells of the stomach lining. And he also found that the intestinal lining had changes in those little villi. Those are these little finger-like projections coming out of the gut, very important for absorption for your listeners. And with this disruption, I could associate that with something that I'm seeing called leaky gut in kids. And we can, I'll just say, we can just hold it for there. But those slides and his work correlated to what I was finding clinically. When I tried to backtrack and said, hey, wait, this guy has research on rats and potatoes. I have a group of kids that are sick with gut dysfunction that I was measuring with laboratory data, clinical findings. And where's the research to back up what I'm finding? Where is that big gap filler of science? And there wasn't any. Horrifying, right? This was like, this is shocking stuff. So that was some of the aha moments for me that enabled me to look at children based on the science with a big need for more science filler. And so I had to use something called clinical acumen. Imagine using my clinical judgment, doing something as horrific as, oh my God, changing their diet to a non-industrial food, organic-based diet. And Dr. Adams and I covered that quite a bit in the book. And lo and behold, kids and families got better. So
I
can also speak to the sort of predicament that started in 1996 in the larger context. You know, a lot of listeners probably heard about GMO foods and they know it's controversial. And as I said, most people would go to the internet and say, oh, this is a bunch of conspiracy theorists. But, you know, people really don't know the history of genetically modified foods in large part, I find. And what's interesting is that, you know, these foods came into existence after like a 20-year period of scientific research at big agrochemical companies and on the tail end of biomedical research for genetic modification in medicine. And they were designed in order to deal with the problem of, you know, recognition that pesticides like DDT were terrible. So in the aftermath of trying to get rid of the worst chemical contaminants, the effort was made to create genetic modification of plants, food plants, such that they would need less pesticides. And when we say pesticides, we're talking about both insecticides and herbicides. So killing bugs that are pests and killing other weeds that compete with the plant. So this led to this growth in the development of genetically modified foods. And you want us to talk a little bit about what these foods are?
Well, I think we could get to that. One thing that I specifically wanted to ask you to comment on, Vincent, because, you know, I've got to the same, as I said, the same mountaintop, the same perspective as you all have. I've come through it, one, really looking at adult coronary disease, and I'm old, so I remember back in the day that nobody thought about clots. We just thought that, you know, you ate too much prime rib. And that fat hardened in your arteries, right? Hardening of the arteries. And then eventually, by the time you were 50 or 60, you had to punch your ticket for a life of excess. And then sort of the information came about, and we learned about inflammation and then chronic inflammation and chronic continuous inflammation. And lo and behold, as Hippocrates once said, all disease starts in the gut. And here we are having this conversation. But I wanted to ask you a little bit more about sort of the political, societal perspective on how we got here, Vincent, because there's something that's always bothered me a little bit. And it actually goes back into the 50s when we first started letting these corporations affect our food supply by changing our food through the generally recognized as safe or GRAS Act, because that basically put the ability to add foodstuffs or change our food, food pathways in the hands of the companies that profit from those types of products, basically the fox in charge of the hen house. And that is something that I saw continue with the approval, and to this day continues with the approval of GMOs. And am I wrong, and if so, let me know where I went wrong on that.
No, you're absolutely right. You've got it perfectly right. I mean, there are different regulatory processes in the UK and in the US. And in the US, the GRAS or generally recognized as safe rubric is the one that's used. And it's just one of the regulatory holes that GM foods fall through. People don't realize that genetic modification techniques used in the biomedical world produce products like insulin, which are very good, but they've all been tested on humans. Genetically modified foods have never actually been tested on humans. And what has happened is that the regulatory agencies rely on the industries themselves to produce most of the data that's used in the evaluation of whether they're safe or not. In fact, a lot of the food isn't even tested because it's classified as generally recognized as safe. And they are convinced that they are equivalent, substantially equivalent to foods that are already existing on the market. And there's this argument about, well, we don't test all of our food. Why would we test this food? But in fact, the EPA also has regulatory holes. The USDA has regulatory holes around genetically modified foods. And so a lot of these have gotten into the system. The other thing to remember is that the whole infrastructure of corporations that have for-profit intentions around their products being connected to large universities where, in theory, independent research is being done changed dramatically with the advent of the development of genetically modified foods and with pharmaceutical products. And that was really the work of one of the biggest corporations of Monsanto. In other words, the people that they hired were the ones that designed these corporate ties to universities such that now almost all of the departments that do research on foods and agrochemical industries in relation to foods are being paid for or largely funded by the corporations. Those corporations also make a point of, since they're funding many of the researchers who do this work, getting these people onto regulatory boards and advisory boards and even the boards of journals that review this work. So it's a pretty much a revolving door between industry and all of the places where the science is being done on this.
So, Dr. Mike, now you can see why a clinician and a medical anthropologist is a perfect marriage.
It really is, you know, and you guys bring a very important perspective, really covering a broad area when it comes to food. You know, my own take on food and health as a chef, you know, I kind of got in this the back door simply because, you know, my friends are chefs. I'm a professional chef. I like to eat yummy tasting food. And so with the whole farm to table movement that started, you know, several decades ago, actually further back in your area of the woods, California, with Alice Waters and her whole crew down there, that all of a sudden, once we started, you know, taking food that simply tasted better because it was fresh, it was real, it was organic, you know, the medical community started to notice, wow, these people are healthier. And there is a difference between, you know, the GMO products and, you know, eating food as nature intended it. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, I wanted you guys to comment on specifically is when we're talking about GMOs, we are not sort of, as you said, you know, insulin is produced by GMOs, et cetera. We're not taking issue with the tool, with the mechanism of using genetically modified organisms. What we're specifically talking about is when they do it to things that enter into our food supply. And let me take an example, Monsanto GMO corn. One of the things that is a passion with me is the whole issue about the herbicide Roundup. One of the things is that because that corn now becomes immune to the effects of Roundup through the GMO, Roundup accumulates in our food source. And that is something that has not really been tested. So, you know, I think you guys would agree with me that we're not talking about the tool. We're talking about just one application of that toolbox when it comes to our foods.
Dr. Mike, you're right on. So we are not opposed to the process. As you mentioned already, insulin is a genetically modified product by E. coli, a simple bacteria. And so there are medicinal uses that are phenomenal. What we are concerned about is the process, as you talk about. How this genetic engineered food got started without human testing is quite astonishing. That in itself is an issue. Other medical products, medicines, for example, are tested by the FDA before they're released. So this is one thing we take issue with. Additionally, we now know through research, mostly by a PhD from the UK, Dr. Michael Antonio, that there are issues medically with the genetic engineered process and the Roundup, as well as when those two products are put together, they're problematic as well. So at first, there was very little literature on the effect of the genetic modification process on us, and now we know from early 1996, Dr. Pusey's work, as well as work into this year by Dr. Michael Antonio, that the genetic modification process causes changes in our bodies. It causes something called oxidative stress, and he did great research. He also showed that in ultra-low doses of Roundup without the genetic modification process causes changes, causative, not correlated, meaning it actually causes non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So then when you pair these two together, other researchers like Dr. Seralini showed that the GM process and the Roundup caused the most harm. So we have good data on this process and that it's indeed toxic. Unfortunately, as we keep stressing, we don't have human data. We also know that glyphosate, which is the active component in Roundup, has nasty side effects. We know it's an antibiotic. We know it's a chelator, which means it binds metals, and you need those metals to run, lots and lots of reactions in your body, like 200 of them in your brain, for example, if you look at magnesium or zinc.
And I just want to jump in because you bring up a very interesting story, which is most people don't realize glyphosate was actually developed in the 50s in Switzerland as a pharmaceutical, and it didn't work. But where the crossover to pesticide came about is because they were looking for a chelating agent to treat hard water. And glyphosate derivatives are great, powerful binders of things, as you said, calcium, magnesium, et cetera, cobalt, which we need for vitamin B12, et cetera. So it's kind of an Roundup, as you can probably tell, is sort of one of my areas of issue because it's in so much of the foodstuffs. And actually, I want to get your comment on this because one of the things people don't realize is that the use of things like Roundup is not decreasing because it's such an effective herbicide. What's happening is what we see with antibiotics, which is nature is much smarter than us. What is it, about 100 million acres of American cropland right now are growing Roundup-resistant or glyphosate-resistant weeds. And so now the next generation of genetically engineered crops are exhibiting multiple resistances. And within the last 10 years, about two-thirds, if you look worldwide, almost 75%, that's when all the glyphosate has been deployed on our croplands. So we're not having something that's so effective like treating smallpox, where, you know, we wonder if we need to vaccinate anyone from smallpox anymore. We're seeing the exact opposite. So if I can get your take on that and some comments and maybe even some thoughts as to, oh my gosh, what do we do?
Ah, great. So you've got it. I mean, you're right on the same page as us. It's true. The increase in glyphosate alone in the last decade has been 240-fold. So people, you know, glyphosate's been around a long time. Roundup has been around a long time. The genius of the scientists in terms of GM foods was in designing a plant that would resist being killed when sprayed with Roundup or by glyphosate. So what's happened with resistance, weed resistance, is that over the years they've had to increase the amount of Roundup that's sprayed, basically filling the soil, filling the water system, you know, drenching the plant with, so it's absorbing a lot of the ingredients and the toxic ingredients in Roundup. And that's just increased and increased over the last two decades since the introduction of these plants, these genetically modified plants. And, you know, getting into the weeds a little bit, it's probably good for people to understand that, you know,
that was a great pun. I got to interrupt you because that was a fabulous pun. And I'm going to steal that one. So go ahead and get back into the weeds.
Sorry, do you want me to continue on with that?
I did. I just said that was absolutely a brilliant segue and pun. It was so good it couldn't go without comment. So you can jump now. You can jump back into the weeds for our audience to follow you.
Okay, right. Now that we're in the weeds, it's important for people to know what the science is and how glyphosate really works. As Michelle mentioned, it's an antibiotic. We don't know how much of it is actually killing you know, cells in the human body. But when it was designed, the assumption was that it would be safe for humans because it only is effective on plant cells, that it disrupts what's called the shikimate pathway, which is what the plant needs to produce its own amino acids. Well, we now know that the human body consists of this thing called the microbiome, and somewhere between 90%, well, either 9-to-1 or a 1-to-1 ratio of cells in our body are made up of microbes, consist of microbes. So these microbes, it turns out, are like plants, and they do have the shikimate pathway. So it's clear that what was not known when they designed this and thought it was safe for humans is now becoming obvious as a problem, because we do have plants in our bodies. We have microbes in our bodies that are being disrupted by these things. So that's one thing to remember in the weed area. But the other area that people aren't really aware of, I don't think, is this other type of genetic modification called BT, and these are the two that we really focus on in the book, the Roundup Ready crops and the BT crops, which constitute about 80% of the crops grown in the U.S., if not more in some cases. So we're talking about corn, soy, canola, sugar beet, and then, of course, we know wheat isn't genetically modified yet, but it is apparently sprayed with quite a bit of Roundup before it's harvested to prevent it from sprouting.
It's grown. We found it actually not far from you. It's been reported somehow I'm doing air quotes here, folks, the dreaded air quotes, escaped into Oregon, Washington, and Montana. And, you know, once these things get out there, they can be difficult to eradicate. The same thing's happened with a rapeseed or canola. It's escaped from the confines of farms. And now these genetically modified plants are growing, you know, along the roadside. So, you know, it's the old Jurassic Park thing. You can't keep them confined. And I'm afraid we're going to see some. One of my great fears is we're going to start to see this genetically modified wheat in no short order. So I just wanted to throw that in there. So I apologize. Go ahead.
Right.
Keep going.
Well, I mean, a couple of things. One, the truth is they are right now running out of the capacity to handle weed control with just Roundup. So they are going to more toxic forms of pesticides, herbicides, including ones that they're combining with genetic modifications, new kinds of genetic modifications. So that's happening all the time. It's like an arms race, really. And unfortunately, we're the side, you know, we're the victims of this arms race. But I was going to mention something about the other type of genetic modification, because Roundup Ready crops are certainly a very important one and a huge problem. But the other type is the one that's usually used by people to say, actually, genetic modification has reduced the use of pesticides. And that's the use of this thing called BT. So BT crops are usually stacked with the traits that are needed for Roundup Ready crops as well. So they're combined in the same seed. But the way BT works is it's a naturally occurring bacillus that's been used by many years by farmers. And when sprayed on the plants, in theory, it can be washed off. But the way BT works is it kills insects. This is the insecticide form of pesticide that we're worried about. And the way it works is when the insect eats it, when it eats this BT, proteins that are generated get into the gut of the insect, and it punches holes in the lining of the gut, and then the animal dies by way of a form of sort of septicemia. It dies from infection.
So, now, Professor, again, are those the things called cry proteins? Do I have that right?
Yes. Yes, okay. You got that right. So when scientists designed BT to occur inside of the genes of the plant, instead of being sprayed on the outside, they incorporated it into the genes of the plant so that an insect that eats any part of that plant, including the fruit, including humans who eat that fruit, will be eating what is essentially a pesticide. And those pesticides, the cry protein, originally it was thought that it wouldn't be activated in the human gut because the human gut is less, because the acidity is very different between insects and humans. But we now know that the BT proteins that are used in these plants are pre-activated. So we really don't know, but we suspect that they're also having an impact on human gut.
Wow.
Now, the thing is that insecticides, BT crops, really do reduce the need for other insecticides. But the way that they do it, essentially, is by turning the plant itself into a pesticide. So we are now eating the pesticides.
We are now eating pesticides. So, doctors, before we go, where can folks find out more information, get the book, et cetera?
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Mike. They can find the book on ChelseaGreen.com. That's our publisher. On Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble is carrying it, other bookstores. So any of those sites, they can pick up a copy. We're happy to
give them the title.
Okay. It's called What's Making Our Children Sick? How Industrial Food is Causing an Epidemic of Illness and What Parents and Doctors, hello, can do about it. There's no hello in the title.
Yeah, so you can just Google What's Making Our Children Sick and our book will come up.
Well, that is great. Doctor, it was so great. This went way too fast. So I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to come back on the program and we can pick up this conversation because you guys have a wealth of knowledge we got to get out there.
Dr. Mike, thank you so much. And dude, you've done your homework. We're thrilled to be here and great chatting with you.
Great to be on the same team. Thank you so much for having us. We'd love to come back.
Thank you, guys. And folks, until we meet again, may the only pain in your life be champagne.